Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, who wants to have a rational discussion about gender issues that neither excludes nor demonizes men? HBR Talk with Hannah Wallen. In August of 2014, feminist outlet Elite Daily published a listicle titled If I Were a Boy, featuring images of 12 feminist bloggers holding signs containing their projections regarding gender differences and how children are treated, and basically how boys are somehow responsible for that narrative. One of the most laughable images featured a slightly miffed-looking young woman whose sign said, If I were a boy, I'd take the time to have a conversation. Well, of course you would, princess. You would need to because there are some serious issues that need to be discussed. Discrimination against boys in education, fathers in family court, men in general in the criminal court, and male partners of female abusers under intimate partner and sexual violence law all come to mind. When a man or boy is a victim of domestic violence, he has few, if any, places to go for help. If he's victimized in the workplace, is his complaint taken seriously? If his wife leaves him, why is he responsible for her standard of living after the divorce if she's not equally responsible for his? Those are necessary conversations, important to both sexes. Of course we should take the time to have them, and guys have been begging to do that for decades. Yeah, m'lady would most certainly take the time for it if she were a boy. But she's not, so she doesn't have to. She can just stand in front of a camera holding a whiny, stereotype-perpetuating sign to create an image for a listicle that other feminist women will read while cheering, Yes! And You Go, Girl! As no conversation of any kind actually takes place. What happens when a guy offers to actually start one? Ask Dr. Warren Farrell. For years, his manner of conversation was thoroughly accepted by feminists as it struck them as strictly a discussion about how men can support women's advancement in society. His decades-long career includes several books, university teaching, public speaking on gender issues, awards like the California Association of Marriage and Family Therapists Award for Outstanding Contribution to the Field of Psychology in 1988, and the Pioneer in the Psychology of Fatherhood Award from OnStep Institute for Mental Research in 2000. He's served on the boards for multiple feminist organizations, including the National Organization for Women in New York, 3 times. His writing encompasses both men's issues and women's issues. Hardly a man you'd expect to be labeled an opponent of women's rights. Dr. Farrell began parting ways with the movement's orthodoxy in the mid-70s, as he stated in a 1997 interview for MenWeb.com, when the National Organization for Women came out against the presumption of joint custody in divorce cases. That position was in conflict with everything the available information on child outcomes following divorce indicates. From his own analysis of research on post-divorce family arrangements, Dr. Farrell identified 3 conditions that are vital to the welfare of children in divorcing families. Equally shared parenting, or joint custody, close parental proximity, and no bad-mouthing. He has testified in child custody cases as an expert witness on the basis of this analysis. Why would there be controversy over a speaker with such credentials? Because he does something that is terrifying to ideologues. Rather than view the world in black and white, angel and devil terms, he instead considers facts, analyzes ideas and information, recognizes human tendencies, cares more about probabilities and possibilities than politics, and is focused far more on advancement than on victim narratives. The more apparent that has become, the more establishment feminists have decided they hate him. They don't want to have a conversation with a man who moves right past who has it worse to discuss what is or is not working right, what are the underlying causes, and what can be done about it. That'd be like a discussion about how to roast the goose that laid the golden eggs. So, what do they do when the conversation has already been started? 6 years ago, the Canadian Association for Equality organized a lecture by Dr. Farrell at the University of Toronto. Campus feminists, women's studies majors, and the Canadian Union of Public Employees, not a campus organization, staged a protest, raised hell, blocked the doors, threatened attendees, and necessitated police presence due to their aggressive, violent behavior. This response has occurred enough times that men's issue speakers often have had to raise funds for police presence on campuses that have allowed them a platform. This is what it sounds like when gender feminists respond to guys trying to take the time to have a conversation.
Can you shut the fuck up for a second, too? Fucking brave apologist, incest supporting, woman hating, fucking scum.
This hasn't stopped equality groups like CAFE from striving to have that conversation as feminists claim to want. They have organized numerous events, including other lectures, educational initiatives, and the founding of the Canadian Center for Men and Families. While there are countless such organizations for women, prior to the opening of the center, there was no central place to address men's issues, and few places even willing to assist men fleeing family violence. The center is Canada's first organization specifically for abused men, rather than adding men on as an afterthought to services reserved mainly for women. The organization is not political, but has been accused by established women's organizations anyway. When CAFE talks about men's issues and the lack of available resources for men in comparison to the wealth of resources available to women, gender feminists respond not by agreeing that men deserve resources as well, but by accusing the organization of attacking women's resources. Obviously, this is intended to address such controversial statements as, initiatives to combat violence against women are necessary and praiseworthy, but policies should be built on facts rather than bound by ideologies. In light of their outrage, it is evident that at least the establishment body of gender feminists consider anything that gets too close to an egalitarian approach to human rights and resources for those whose human rights are violated to be an attack on feminism. This is why they oppose and protest against any effort to bring men into the conversation on gender issues as equally deserving human rights activists. During the 6 years since the initial Toronto protest, CAFE has been weathering establishment attacks on its reputation and initiatives, continuing to promote a non-exclusive examination of these issues, to, in other words, have that conversation. On November 16, 6 years to the day after the meme-spawning protest of his original talk, CAFE has organized another lecture by Dr. Warren Farrell at the University of Toronto. We've invited co-founder Justin Trottier to discuss this event and its history tonight on HBR Talk. Hello and welcome to HBR Talk 56. Oops, that's 57. Obviously, now you know I'm copy-pasting. Welcome to HBR Talk 57, A Conversation. I am your host, Hannah Wallen, here with that adorable specter of death, Prim Reaper, she who must be obeyed, Karen Strawn, and one of the Canadian Association for Equality's most fearless leaders, Justin Trottier, to discuss Dr. Warren Farrell's upcoming talk at the University of Toronto, organized by CAFE. But before we get into that conversation, we have to have this one. A quick reminder, we're also on Twitch and Facebook, so if YouTube goes offline again, we won't. And if you're on YouTube, remember that the main chat for live streams is the Badger Live Streams channel. So if you're on the other one, hop on over. If you want to catch our show in its audio format, or you want to be sure you'll always be able to catch our live streams, remember to go to badgerfeed.com and register to receive notifications. And with all of those non-shadow bans, you need those, or you may not know when we're on at all. And last but not least, don't forget to like and share this and other Honey Badger live streams so they'll be seen by other people. Think of it as a chance to thumb your nose at the establishment. And with that, we have the ever-shortened shill out of the way. So, Justin, would you like to tell us a little bit about the upcoming event?
I would be delighted. And let me just first thank you and your colleagues for having me back on the show. It's always a pleasure to be joining you here. So about 6 years ago, we had Warren Farrell come to speak to us at the University of Toronto. And before then, our organization at U of T, the University of Toronto Men's Issues Awareness Society, was pretty much a fledgling organization in its infancy. And we had put on a few events up to that point, but the attendance had been modest at best. But everything changed with Dr. Farrell. We had a couple hundred people come out to the event, or rather try to attend the event, because what quickly happened back in 2012 was that there was a protest, which actually degenerated into what I would describe as a riot, because there was actually abuse and violence and doors being blocked and police and guests alike being harassed and threatened. And we were able to go ahead with the event, but not everybody was able, unfortunately, to get in to see Dr. Farrell. So fast forward 6 years later, actually to the day. So November 16th, 2012 was when all of this happened. And again, November 16th, this time 2018, Warren will be back at U of T in the very same venue for a repeat of that event, but hopefully with a different outcome. This time we're going to be much more prepared and we're going to be ready for whatever confronts us. We do hope for obviously a peaceful, engaging event, but whatever comes, we will be ready for it.
Now, has the university taken a different approach to security this time than they initially did? Are they a little more prepared prior to the event this time than they were in the past?
So they have had 6 years in a way to prepare for this. And after Warren's event, which caught all of us off guard, myself and CAFE, as well as the university administration, there were a number of events that quickly followed Warren's talk, because that was part of a monthly lecture series we were doing. And many of those events in the year or so after that were protested. So there were lots of experiments in how to deal with disruptions or attempted disruptions. And over time, we all got better at coming up with strategies to make sure that the event could proceed successfully. Now, the good news is in the last 2.5 to 3 years, there hasn't been any kind of protest or disruption. We've continued to do our events. It's not that we've backed away at all. But for whatever reason, the protesters and the rioters have not been showing up, which I think is very good news. They know that we're not going anywhere. So I don't know what's going to happen. We have no reason 3 weeks out from the event to believe that there's going to be a protest. We don't have any evidence that anything is being planned. But as you probably know, these things, if they're going to happen, they tend to come together at the last minute. So we probably won't know until much closer to the date.
And there are a couple of factors that may make a difference. I know just from doing a little research, the part of the reason that the protesters were able to stir up such a hornet's nest that particular time was that there had been a publication with a reporter that essentially either misunderstood or flat out lied about an interview with Dr. Farrell, and claimed that he had said some very inflammatory things that he hadn't actually said, and attributed some inflammatory things that he had gathered in interviews with other people to him. So the conclusion among feminists ended up being that he supported things that he didn't support. So that I know has been corrected on the record numerous times, and even the Wikipedia page on him, Wikipedia is pretty biased politically, even that reflects that correction. Although it leaves it a little more up in the air. But the reality is there may not be as much fuel to get those protesters fired up. So hopefully you guys will have an easier time of it. Now, his topic this time around is going to be a different topic, isn't it?
Yes and no. I mean, back in 2012, by coincidence or perhaps by design, the topic was the boy crisis. This year, again, it's the boy crisis.
Okay.
But this year, it's a conversation that's a little bit broader than it was 6 years ago. So back then, we were looking more narrowly at boys' underachievement in post-secondary educational institutions with a focus on Canada. This year, he's talking about his new book, which happens to be called The Boy Crisis, but it's looking at the boy crisis much more generally. So yes, we're going to be talking about education, but we're also going to be talking about the consequences of growing up in fatherless homes, how that leads to the boy crisis. We're going to be looking at the Me Too movement and how the way in which all men sort of get caught up as perpetrators or would-be perpetrators of sexual harassment or sexual abuse, how that casts a shadow on the prospects of men growing up within that sort of cultural environment. So we're going to be looking at it through a current affairs kind of lens and looking at issue by issue how all of these things add up to make it such that boys are failing to launch, as Warren would put it.
So is this kind of going to be like sort of a longer version of the talk that he gave not too long ago in Calgary then?
Yes, it will be similar to that. That one was also focused on the boy crisis in the Canadian context. And it was an opportunity for Warren to discuss some of the insights and the research from his book by the same name, but also right. to apply them to a Canadian kind of context and background. And he'll be doing that again this time around.
Oh, perfect. Unfortunately, that one did not garner any negative attention, and he was actually quite surprised that it didn't. So hopefully the same will be true over there.
Well, I think, honestly, that the opposition is getting to the point where they're realizing that they can't just blindly protest stuff that is becoming more and more well-known in the mainstream. You know, I keep going back to my experiences back in like 2009, 2010 online when I would bring up things like male victims of domestic violence and feminists. The feminists who engaged me in any kind of conversation would say essentially that they don't exist. If they do exist, they are a tiny, tiny, tiny minority of victims. And that the existence of those male victims is almost like the exception that proves the rule, that domestic violence is a male perpetrated crime against women. It's essentially violence against women. And now what I'm seeing is more and more feminists who choose to engage or who choose with me or who choose to make statements in public will say, well, yes, we know that there is a significant proportion of victims of domestic violence who are men. We know this, right? And we're on it, right? Feminism is the cure for this. Feminism is the one that the ideology that's going to take care of this. Dog, toenails, what? I think that essentially what they're having to do is they are having to give ground on issues as they become more widely known in the mainstream but then they'll take credit. Well, feminists are the ones who always knew that men could be victims of sexual assault or men could be victims of domestic violence. Feminists are the ones who always knew that, you know, this, that, and the other about the male experience. And feminists are the ones who are doing something about it. And don't listen to those MRAs over there and don't listen to CAFE, because they're just a bunch of right-wing, alt-right MRA incel types, you know, and all of that. So, you know, and I'm not saying all feminists, Justin, because I know that you do actually do some work, some bridge building and all of that with groups that would be considered feminist.
Absolutely.
But sort of the mainstream pop culture feminists out there, the ones that I engage with online, they're essentially saying, well, you know, feminists always knew this and we were the first ones to discover it, you know, after we'd been shoving it in their face for 20 years, us MRAs, right? And you just don't listen to those MRAs because they just hate women. We'll take care of this whole thing. And so it really is, it's like, they're not going to be, I don't think that they're going to be able to protest Warren Farrell and get away with it. They're just not going to be, they won't look good.
And this is one of the reasons why I differentiate between gender feminists and equity feminists. I've been able to actually see progress with equity feminists. Like, I think Christina Hoff Sommers identifies as an equity feminist. And while I don't agree with the ideology, even at the equity feminist level, I don't agree that women have always been oppressed. I don't agree that women were disadvantaged in comparison to men. I believe that everybody had their disadvantages, and some of those disadvantages were gendered, but for everything that men experienced, there was a parallel for women, and vice versa. But I do agree that equity feminists are more progress-oriented, real progress, not, make laws that canonize the Duluth model on domestic violence approaches that turns out that the people who created it, at least one of them said, oh yeah, we made all that crap up and we were wrong. So
just sort of reinforcing that distinction, yeah, between equity feminists and more ideological feminists or whatever other terms you want to use. We have found we can make surprising progress by working with frontline staff within social service and community health agencies. So the reason why the frontline staff are easier to work with is these are the people who are actually dealing with both men and women that come in looking for services, whether that's, you know, coming in looking for legal support because they're going through family court, or they're coming to victim service agencies looking for support because they're dealing with trauma and abuse and violence. The frontline service providers, they know that a lot of these issues are affecting both men and women in comparable and significant ways. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. Last summer, we did a workshop for the Ontario Network of Sexual Assault Treatment Centers. So these are essentially nurses who operate within Ontario's hospitals. And if women come in and they show signs that they may be victims of domestic abuse or sexual abuse, these nurses have special training to support them. So this network of nurses came to us because they want to do this for men. Because they're frontline nurses. They know that men are also coming into the emergency room of hospitals because of domestic abuse, sometimes even because of sexual violence. And so they want to be able to have the training and the support from an agency like ours to do a better job for those men. And then I love this because this literally happened while we were preparing for the show. I got an email about 20 minutes ago from a woman that I've been corresponding with. She's with the Ontario assault line for female victims of abuse. And she's reached out to us just this week. And again, it's because she knows what it's like to be on the receiving end of phone calls from men and women who are looking for support. And yes, a lot of men will call an assault line that is branded for women because there's not really a lot of other options for men to go to. So we have lots of examples where we have these women. They're even feminists for the most part. They would call themselves that. But they're on the front lines. They're probably equity feminists, or at least they're feminists who care more about supporting whoever needs support than they are about waging ideological battles. And that's very much aligned with our philosophy as well when it comes to gender inequality.
And I had somebody ask in the chat what the difference is between an equity feminist and the other type I would call ideological feminist is good. I also think gender feminist is a good one, too. Simply because you have this focus on gender among some feminists to the degree that they want to be exclusive of men in terms of human rights initiatives and things like that. So I guess my solid definition would be a feminist is an equity feminist if their focus is on simply ensuring non-discrimination, not tokenism, not reverse discrimination, not special treatment for one sex or the other, not demonization of one sex or the other, but just equal treatment all across the board. And where there are problems that affect one gender or the other, looking at realistic solutions for those problems rather than focusing on things like blame and demonization and perpetual victimhood. But the gender feminist turns it the other way around, and the gender feminist is more focused on the idea of a patriarchy that where women have been oppressed by men throughout history and so on, and they're going to be more focused on how they can make money out of perpetual victimhood or how they can make, arrange their life, their social life around that perpetual victimhood. And either way, they're not going to be accepting of the idea that if there is an issue that affects both genders, even if the solutions for both genders are not the same, that it's valuable to pursue solutions for both genders in respect to that issue.
Well, and I think we're seeing a few good, just really quickly, because I know a number of you are in Alberta, and there's a couple of shelters that you probably know, women's shelters that have, domestic abuse shelters for women, that is, that have indicated just in the last few months that they're going to start accepting men. And I think that's a great example of probably what happened was you have women and feminists within that organization who had to do a lot of lobbying internally to their executive directors and their supervisors to make the case on behalf of the men who are trying to access these services. So we should try to find allies where we can, is I think my lesson from my experiences. And there's plenty of women within these agencies that tend to be women's agencies, but there's plenty of women in there who get it, who are very close to where we're at on these issues. And those are the people that we need to find and we need to work with.
Yeah, I think Justin's right. And I think I would add that, you know, essentially the higher up you go in the hierarchy, the more ideological things tend to become, right? So the frontline workers, the on the ground workers, the foot soldiers, essentially, who are doing the hands-on care for people in need and people in crisis, right? They're seeing stuff that is contrary to the ideology, but the people who are teaching courses in university and who are maybe doing political lobbying, you know, at the highest levels of government and all of those things, that Women's Legal Education and Action Fund, and those types of groups, the leadership of those groups are often they're in an ivory tower, they're in a bubble where they don't experience these things. And they are more able, you know, the Jessica Valentis of the world are more able to maintain the delusion that these things only affect women, and that men are responsible for all of the bad things in the world, but yet somehow none of the good things in the world. So
I would say that's an all-around problem in academia, within the social sciences, and media, and any classes related to media, is that you get that ivory tower thing going. It's not the same as with something like engineering, where it's the same in academia as it is in the real world. The laws of physics apply no matter what. So yeah, with all that lack of real-world experience makes a big difference.
I can very much attest to the problem with the social sciences and things like that. I've been doing a video series on exactly that subject on and you can just see where the people are talking about these kinds of issues as though it is like a patriarchal problem and that kind of thing. They're not really talking about it in terms of, you know, the feminist definition of equality, the ones that equity feminists might endorse. They're talking about it in terms of the more common definition of feminism, that is, you know, advocacy for equality in terms of bringing women up to men's level and things of that nature. But that being said, I wanted to kind of touch base on something that was just said a few seconds ago, because I think it's very exciting. The fact that some women's shelters in Alberta are starting to accept men, I think that is relevant to our interests in another way. I was wondering if by chance you happen to know which shelters those were, because that could give us some ideas for another subject we'll be talking about tonight.
Yes, I don't recall the names, but I know there's one in Red Deer, and I think the other one is in Grand Prairie. I can look them up while we're chatting.
Awesome. All right. That's great. That's great news. I really hope that we can continue that trend.
Yes, the Grand Prairie shelter? Oh, wow. Wow.
Is that a big turnaround?
No, because I reamed them out. Okay.
Oh, wow.
Because we did a red pill screening in Grand Prairie, and all of a sudden, a woman who was who worked at this women's shelter in Grand Prairie got up on stage and started saying that, you know, the whole thing is bullshit and Aaron Pitsey is insane, and you know, all of you are out to lunch and we do help women, right? Help men rather. And a man in the audience stood up and he also worked at that shelter and said, yeah, we do help men. And I was just like, yeah, okay. So I'm looking at your website and, I don't see anything there for men. I don't see any mention of men other than as aggressors. So if you're actually getting men coming to you, right. And yeah, thank you for helping them. Right. But how many men are not reaching out to you because it's like they're walking past a lingerie store or an underwear store and all they see is women's underwear and women's nightwear and sleepwear and pajamas on display and the logo is like a pink bra, right? Okay, and are they going to walk in thinking maybe there's a pair of boxer shorts in the back for them? No, they're not even going to call you. Why are you not doing outreach? Why are you not letting men know that you actually will help them if they call you? Because your website doesn't tell them that. And so essentially, I'm thinking that maybe that got through them.
Somebody may have listened.
Well, I hate to disappoint you. I've done a bit of fact finding on my own statement, and I was wrong. It's the one in Grand Prairie. It's the one in red in Medicine Hat.
Damn it.
I am really sorry about that. But I can tell you this, that we did cafe that is followed up with the lady, Jacqueline Kish, I believe is her name, who you're referring to, came out to the event in Grand Prairie, Alberta. And she has formally endorsed our plan to open a family shelter for abused men and children in Toronto. So she's attached her name to our project, and she's actually provided us with the material support. So something is happening with her. She's put her money where her mouth is to some extent, but I'm afraid that their shelter, as far as I know, is not one of those that has changed their policy.
Oh, bummer. You know, they did say that they will fly men down, male victims down to the, at that time, one shelter in Alberta that had beds for male victims, which was in Strathmore. So, you know, we're talking Red Deer, Strathmore, Medicine Hat. What is it with Southern Alberta that they're the only ones who seem to, like, be aware of this issue? So,
but you're missing
maybe it's something
picture.
In the water.
Something progressive is happening in Alberta. We don't have this in Ontario. We don't have any that I'm aware of in Ontario that are changing policy with respect to accepting men. And I don't know any others. There is one in Winnipeg. There's actually the only Canadian men's shelter for abused men is in Winnipeg. But other than that, I'm not aware of any other examples other than these new progressive, to be fair, examples in Alberta. And I don't, as the only man on the line, I don't want to be seen to be coordinating or controlling the conversation. But since we're talking about Alberta, may I just very quickly talk about CAFE's expansion plans?
Because yes, Alberta's I was going to ask you about that, actually.
I was hoping we would.
Yes.
Thank you. That was not a very artful segue there. But
no worries, man.
We've launched a campaign. We've been doing these for the last few years, and thankfully with support from from your show and from any of your listeners, in big part, we've been successful. So in the last year, we raised a significant amount of capital to open a shelter. I just referred to it, Family Shelter in Toronto. And we're now going after government support, just so you know where that is. So we haven't opened the shelter yet because we're really hoping that having raised $250,000 from private sources, that the government will see that there actually is community buy-in for this project, and then that they will come in and maybe even match that. So there are conversations happening there. But in the meantime, we have some really amazing opportunities in Alberta. And so our first center west of Ontario is going to be in Calgary. We've committed to doing that. And we've just launched a Patreon page, our first time using Patreon. So we had to learn the ropes a little bit. So that's now up at patreon.com/menandfamilies. And that project's being headed by Dr. Dan McKinnon. So for those of you who are at our national conference in Calgary in June, you would have met Dan. Dan is a phenomenal and amazing and kind-hearted man who's built a really incredible team in Calgary and then also throughout Alberta working with our other branches throughout the province. So we're feeling really, really good about the plan that we have here. We have another matching opportunity. So we have a donor who will match contributions that come in up to the end of the year. But for those who set up a Patreon profile, he will match 6 times the value of that monthly gift. So if you set up $30 a month, he's not matching 30, he's actually going to match 180, just as an incentive. We're trying to make this as easy as possible on people to go ahead and to take advantage of that opportunity and to be part of the next big thing for CAFE and for the Canadian Centre for Men and Families. So please take advantage of that while that opportunity is available.
And that was patreon.com/menandfamilies, correct?
You got it.
All right. I will try to make sure we get that in our low bar.
Yeah, I wanted to add too, because one of the most interesting things that I've noticed is, Alberta seems to be this hub where all of this stuff is happening, and we don't really have a whole lot of resources to make it happen. But at least not in terms of human capital, because essentially there aren't very many people that we're pulling on it in terms of volunteerism and all of that. But one of the things that I noticed when, I don't know, Justin, if you watched this, it was on Netflix. I featured fairly significantly in this little mini documentary called Follow This, the men's rights movement, that was the host was Sachi Cool. I don't know if you know her. She's from BuzzFeed. But instead of, I went and I sat down and I did a 90-minute interview with her in Toronto when I was there for, oh God, I forget what it was that I was there for. I went to an event in Montreal, and then they flew me to Toronto and sat down and did a 90-minute interview with me in Toronto, and then I flew home. So essentially, in order to show how men's rights activists and, people who men's rights activists support don't do any, instead of showing that they do stuff for men, right, which she could have done by traveling, I guess 15 minutes across town and interviewing you or someone from CAFE, Robert Samory, or, someone from CAFE. She ended up having to fly all the way down to Texas to find a domestic violence shelter for men, and a woman in charge of this shelter who says she's never received any support from men's rights activists. Never, never, not one dime, not one dime, right? And I had never heard of a shelter in Texas that accepted men. This was the first that I'd heard of this person. So I have no idea how much digging that the BuzzFeed team had to do to find this person, when they could have just traveled, they could have just taken a 20-minute Uber ride and gone to CAFE's offices and interviewed you in terms of opening up, a domestic violence shelter specifically for men. But what struck me was Alberta is Canada's Texas. Okay. And the state in the US that has a domestic violence shelter for women that accepts men, that helps men, it puts them up off campus, but it gives them equivalent services, is in Texas. And I'm wondering, do you think, because I know that you're not political, the CAFE is not a political organization, but do you see, and this is one thing that I have seen over the last probably 4 or 5 months of going on talk radio shows and all of that, I have a wonderful patron in Washington, D.C., who is an attorney and very involved, has been for, he's a veteran men's rights sort of influencer, I guess, or behind the scenes person, patron, I guess. He hired me a publicist, and I'm getting almost 100% right wing radio show spots, and I get almost universally positive feedback from the hosts and the callers of these right wing U.S., mostly U.S. radio talk shows. And that's not something that, I don't get invited on left-wing radio shows. I don't get invited anywhere left-wing. And when I do, I don't get, I guess BuzzFeed invited me, and then they essentially said, MRAs are bad people. Only feminists really want to help men. So like, are you seeing what I'm seeing in terms of just sort of the people who are in charge of disseminating information, right? Are you seeing the same kind of thing that I'm seeing in terms of right-wingers seem to be, at the moment, at least more open to the message and to the ideas than those on the left, or what?
That's certainly consistent with my own experiences. And I think what it comes down to is that they have an ability to be, in a weird way, a little bit more open-minded on these things because they're not as boxed in by their constituencies. So even if the political operatives accepted the claims that we made regarding the need for different services, they have so few degrees of freedom because they risk losing different voting blocks if they're perceived to be at all siding with men's rights activists. At least that's the perception. So regardless of what their own personal beliefs are, they don't have a lot of wiggle room because they risk losing votes and losing elections if they're seen to be on the wrong side of different issues. Whereas if you're on the right, your voting blocks are, there's a different dynamic there. And you're unlikely to lose those blocks of votes if you do occasionally support a domestic abuse shelter for men or other men's services, which is why in the case of Ontario, where we recently had a change of government from Liberal to Conservative, we think we might actually have a better shot. The Liberal government was highly unlikely to ever show any kind of sympathy or interest for any of
Kathleen
the
Wynne.
Oh, no.
Kathleen Wynne? Yeah, no, there's no way. There's absolutely no way. She was like hardcore, dyed-in-the-wool, radical feminist. Didn't she put out like $44 million over, 7 years or something like that to raise awareness for the completely, completely unknown concept that some men beat their wives?
Oh my God.
Yeah, no, just for
30 or $40 million campaign to raise awareness of domestic violence and sexual violence.
Harassment.
But all of the advertising framed it as men versus women. So it was a complete example of the gender binary, which, a lot of feminists have educated us to abandon that whole concept. But if you look at all of the ads, the branding was, who will you help? And you were either going to help the male perpetrator or the female victim. In every case, that was your choice.
We've actually developed
a series of PSA video vignettes in response, similarly framed, but where you have a different, very different dynamic. So in some cases, you have female victims. In other cases, you have male victims. And in other cases, you have domestic abuse and same-sex relationships. That's a PSA video that we're about to launch. So this is doing it the way Kathleen Wynne should have done it, because domestic violence and sexual abuse comes in all flavors and all genders and all sexual orientations. That's what she should have done. That's actually the progressive message. So we're going to do the progressive message that former Premier Wynne never got around to doing.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, like, I've actually been asked to kind of start possibly heading up the domestic violence training for the crisis center that I work at, because of the fact that I realize that it happens to men, by men, by women and to women, and in same-sex relationships. And it's really important to actually be promoting that message and not just saying that, oh, this is a thing that men, they occasionally get this happening to them. No, it's actually a lot closer to equal than a lot of people think. Like, this is something that I'm doing a major literature review on, but I didn't really get a chance to mention just previously we were talking. I was trying to sneak in there, but I was doing... I just have to shout over you, Karen. but I was actually doing a lot of research earlier this morning on services in Alberta for men, and I was actually pleasantly surprised to find that there are quite a few targeted support groups and things of that nature. There's really not a lot of shelters yet, but I mean, hopefully we can work towards changing that. But it could actually be helpful not only to find resources for the Calgary area, but also to find resources that the Edmonton branch of CAFE might be able to use to maybe eventually, hopefully, fingers crossed, open up a division up there as well. But let's not put the cart before the horse.
Part of the issue that you're facing here, like what Justin brought up and what Karen pointed out and everything, the biggest problem with identity politics is it's an us versus them mentality rather than a there's problems that need to be addressed. What is the cause behind this problem? What can we do about it? Basically, the thing that I pointed out that Dr. Warren Farrell approaches things as, you know, where he looks at the actual issue itself and he looks at the factors involved and looks for a productive solution, a progressive solution. And I would be like, people have asked about, you know, equity feminist versus gender feminist. And I would say when he was a feminist, Warren Farrell would probably qualify more as an equity feminist based on that. And it's not necessarily a liberal conservative thing so much as a practical versus ideological thing. And if you get all wrapped up in us versus them ideology, you lose the practical entirely. And so
and Warren he's such a principled guy. Yeah. I would also call him an evidence-based feminist back
Absolutely.
When he was a feminist, because he, as is famous for a lot of people, was on the board of directors of the National Organization for Women for 3 years. But then he started looking into things, and the evidence led him to acknowledge that while women have issues and he would continue to talk about them, so do men. And it was in that context that he would be raising that evidence about the issues of both men and women that he started to find that a lot of people didn't want to hear about the evidence for men's issues. And so he said, look, that's where I'm being led by my research. I'm not going to just ignore that because of my ideology. And he's just such an amazing principled guy. And he's in a lot of ways been punished for that, and he's faced some serious consequences for it.
Yeah,
that
being practical doesn't win you any. Yeah, being practical doesn't win you any friends in identity politics at all.
And Murray Strauss said the same thing, was that he found that his scientific commitments overweighed his feminist or ideological commitments when he first published his evidence of gender symmetry and domestic violence. He did that study because he had been studying wife battering, and he had found all kinds of evidence for wife battering. And somebody had said to him, I bet you if you looked at the whole picture, you'd find it was just as much going the other way. And he said, oh, God, no way, no way. This is going to be a slam dunk. I'm going to prove that guy wrong. And the first time he did a study on it, he was like, oh, shit, that guy was right.
And he acknowledged that. And that's what makes the difference, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like one of the things, too, that frustrates me is, you know, like, because I would love to go on the Young Turks again. I would absolutely happily go on the Young Turks again. I would go on Kyle Kalinske's show. I would go on, you know, any kind of, I would happily interview with BuzzFeed again, all of those things. Right. But what they do is they take the absolute, well, actually I'm going to give BuzzFeed credit in their follow this. They did actually put some of the things that I said that are positive regarding men's rights activists, they did actually include a couple of those. But what I'm looking at is if you talk to the right-wing press, they're perfectly happy to hear you out. Even if they're, you know, like I've talked to right-wing radio show hosts who've said, well, I just have never experienced any of these problems that you talk about. So like, I got no clue about any of this. Right. But I'm not saying that it doesn't happen, mm-hmm. you know, and yeah, can you tell me more? And, you know, as a, you know, sort of a talk radio host who has, you know, a syndicated radio show, maybe they don't. they've never experienced certain issues, right? Like, you know, workplace injury or some kind of homelessness or whatever, right? But the left wing right now is just so, and the feminist, I think that I won't say the entirety of feminism, but the feminist establishment, the people who are in those upper tiers of that hierarchy, they just absolutely, I'm going to ask you, Justin, did you watch, Rebecca Sullivan, Professor Rebecca Sullivan's CBC spot on the Red Pill movie?
I think I did a couple of years ago, yeah.
Yeah, that was just absolutely, like, can you imagine, like, and what frustrated me about that was not that she was saying things like, MRAs are advocating mostly for men's sexual rights, meaning if only we could have sex with whoever or whatever we want, whenever we want to, then maybe we wouldn't have to rape you, which is a direct quote on that she presented.
Yes, it's coming back to me now. I remember that.
Yeah. Okay. It wasn't just that she said that. It was that the interviewer was just like, oh, wow, no wonder they're a controversial movement. I totally buy everything you say, and I'm not going to ask you a single challenging question.
Yeah.
And that seems to be, I hate to essentially make this a right, left-right issue, but because I actually do have a number of positions that are firmly on the left, in terms of my own politics, but I, you know, like when that's what you're getting, not from necessarily the professor who was interviewed, but from the interviewer on our nation's broadcaster, our publicly funded broadcaster. She's like, oh yeah, that sounds crazy. Oh, you're super right to oppose these people. They sound nuts. How do you get up every morning, Justin?
Well, I try to remember that we're actually making a real positive difference in the lives of the people that we work with. And I think by virtue of operating a day-to-day service center, I'm in a pretty unique, and I would even say privileged, I think that's the right use of that word, I'm in a privileged place where I can actually see the good that we're doing. And so that's what I focus on when I'm feeling a little bit down or there's been a setback, and those things do happen. But then I realize that, you know, in Toronto, in Ottawa, and soon in Calgary and Edmonton, we have the opportunity to help hundreds and even thousands of men and families reconnect fathers and children, fathers who haven't seen their children in years. We've got plenty of those. We can help men who have been going through abuse and trauma and have been contacting, in some cases, 6 or 7 agencies, and they've all been told that they can't do anything for them. And then they reach out to us and they finally have hope. And they tell me, this is the first time anybody's ever taken me seriously. So those are the kinds of experiences that keep me going.
You know, this is something, again, where I would say, you look for what you can get, where you can get it in terms of solutions. And I think that that's a really good attitude, in terms of, you're trying to accomplish something, it doesn't matter whether most of your solutions are coming from one side or the other. What really matters is whether they're practical and whether they work. And I think, based on what we've been seeing, like what Karen was talking about with the establishment media, the as particularly the left-wing establishment media and the establishment academia and everything, right now it's just not an avenue for a lot of things. You may be able to get some assistance from them or some support from them in terms of supporting single dads in narrow circumstances. But right now they're not going to be supportive of practical solutions for male victims of domestic violence and practical solutions for fathers who want to maintain a close relationship with their children following a divorce or in an unwed parenting situation, because that goes against their narrative. And I think you have the right attitude when it comes to writing things out based on, you know, this is what we are accomplishing, this is what we can accomplish, and following up with those avenues rather than, I don't know, fretting over people not liking you on the other side, you know, and that there is an other side rather than just different viewpoints.
But, I mean, for us, it's often a practical thing that in order for agencies or governments to fund programs for boys and men, those programs have to exist. So one of the criticisms that we often hear, and Karen was just referring to it, is that men's rights groups don't do anything to actually address the problem. If we're seen as doing things to address the problem, it becomes harder to continue to make that kind of criticism. And at the same time, it then means that if governments change their policies and they become more open and friendly to men's services, not to men's rights, you know, politically, but to services for men, then lo and behold, there's now the infrastructure in place to actually take advantage of that. And that kind of brings us back to Alberta, because I think this Texas of Canada, if you want to call it that, when they, and this actually goes to another point Karen made about, you know, conservative governments or media tending to be a little bit more comfortable talking about these things. Back when there was a conservative government in Alberta, there were a number of roundtables that the government organized around fatherlessness, around domestic abuse, around developing a strategy for suicide prevention. And actually, in all of those cases I just mentioned, part of the strategy that was developed was, we need to deal with fatherlessness by coming up with services and programs to empower dads, to help dads through divorce and separation. But of course, no groups were offering that. So when we come along, we can say, look, you've made that a policy priority. Now there's a group that's able to actually do that, that has the track record and expertise to put forward a program to address fatherlessness. We're that group. So I think we're in a really good place, and now I'm putting my cafe hat back on. I think cafe's in a really good place to deliver on that. It's funny that this hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but on suicide, the government of Alberta's health services created a suicide prevention strategy, and they acknowledge middle-aged males is one of their priority groups. But again, no organization in Alberta has said, let's do something about that. Let's actually address that particular issue. We're going to come and we're going to say, you've identified that as a problem because you've seen the research that suicide is very high among middle-aged males. Now we're in a place where we can work with you collaboratively as partners to actually finally address this tragedy of male suicide. But you have to be at the right place at the right time, and you have to be prepared and willing to take advantage of those opportunities and to do it in creative ways, partnerships with women's shelters or whoever else is at least at that time on that issue willing to work with you.
Exactly. And you know, in terms of fathers initiatives, that's one that I don't know how it is in Canada, but in the United States you're probably going to see more enthusiasm for that from conservatives than from the left. Conservatives sort of have this, it's not exactly a monopoly, but a history of campaigning on family unity and on not necessarily the nuclear family, but the idea of being married before you have kids, staying married after you have kids, things like that. And while the politicians, like at least here in the United States, the politicians don't necessarily live up to that all that well, they will still back initiatives intended to support maintaining as much family unity as can be maintained, even after a divorce. So you'll see, like, if you can come up with solutions that address problems of fathers being separated from their children and families maintaining the ability to support the children and so on, that's actually the place to go to look for support with that. And the one thing that they probably, with the men's rights movement, the one area that we will probably see hardship with in terms of, like, we will see support for fathers' rights, we'll see support for equal accountability in terms of things like custody and child support, we'll see support for initiatives to try to maintain marital unity rather than allow divorce to happen too easily. But we will probably not find very many politicians that will support us in the idea of, say, paternal surrender. So even the conservatives are going to be like, nope, we won't support that. So it just, you kind of pick your battles and move forward that way.
And you know, pick your allies on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, you pick your allies on a case-by-case basis as well.
Speaking of case-by-case basis, you know, one thing that I've noticed that hasn't necessarily been drawn on political lines, a lot of the times where I've been seeing support, particularly from women, but one of the areas where I've been seeing a lot of support for, like, fathers who have been alienated from their children is from their partners that are seeing these men go through not being able to see their children anymore. That's where I'm finding the most support in Calgary, for example, is in people who are currently going through that or seeing their husbands going through that. And it's a real shame in a sense that it has to come to that. It has to, like, people actually have to see it in action that close to them in order to take action. But on the other hand, I am glad that there are people who are willing to kind of stand up against it and start taking that stand now that they've seen what it can do to a person. So it's very, very much a matter of picking your allies when they come to you.
This is part of the problem. There's been a fair number of campaigns to portray all fathers who do not keep up with child support obligations as deadbeats. Nobody portrays mothers who have custody of children who do not keep up with visitation obligations as deadbeats. Nobody considers a mom a deadbeat if she tries to sever her child's relationship with the father, even though there is a wealth of research out there that shows that both parents are important to the child, that you can't just remove one parent from the child's life and have no impact on the child from that. So there's a great deal of sympathy for mothers who are put in financial duress because they don't earn enough money to support a family themselves, but they're not getting it from the estranged father. Who is being asked to support two households at that point, his own plus hers. And there's a great deal of sympathy for her if she has to struggle because of that. But there is zero sympathy for the father if he does not earn enough extra money to support himself on top of the amount he's intended or expected to spend to support her household. And, you know, I saw that for firsthand. I am a second wife, and I belonged to a Facebook group when the kids were young that was for second wives. And I've always thought it would be good to start an organization for second wives to sort of unite in support of men who are in this situation, because it's really on paper and from an on paper moral standpoint, it feels really good to blame the guy for the situation, despite the fact that both people's choices went into it initially. And in the situation of unwed parenthood, you know, there were several choices post-conception that the woman had between I'm pregnant and I have custody of this child, support me. And in terms of divorce, 70% is initiated by women. So most of the women who end up as single moms are single moms by choice for whatever reason, and yet we blame the father, who doesn't get a say in whether the mom is a single mom by choice. We blame him for her financial situation. It makes no sense practically. It makes no sense if you pay attention to the details of the situation, and practical solutions to it are not going to be punish, punish, punish. You can't punish a man or any person into wanting to work harder. You can't punish somebody into wanting to have a better relationship with someone, you know. And you can't punish somebody into supporting what they have no connection to. So if you take away a man's connection to his children and then you say, but you got to give her money because she has them, you are doing exactly the opposite of what it takes to keep a father invested in his child's financial outcome. And it's just, it's the kind of thing that needs to be, there needs to be an information campaign going the other way saying, hey, you want fathers to be in their children's lives. Stop putting fences in their way. Stop putting hurdles in their way. Stop beating them over the head for wanting to be in their children's lives. and don't try to squeeze blood from a turnip. You know, deal with the way things really are. Because at this point, none of the good aspects of that are happening, and all of the crazy is what we're left with. But in terms of support for men who are estranged from their kids, you had mentioned some services that CAFE was interested in getting involved with. Do you have some specifics that you can talk about a little more in particular, what you're planning on?
Oh, certainly. Well, one of the policy priorities that the government has developed in Alberta, again, and this is based on some of those roundtable discussions where they're trying to understand and characterize fatherlessness, and then what programs would work, intervention programs to keep fathers and children together, as though we don't already kind of know how to do this. But they did finally come to the conclusion that, first of all, there need to be father-specific programs. So just general parenting programs aren't good enough. We need to finally acknowledge that fathers are different from mothers. They're both equally important, and different programs and different services are required for fathers and mothers, and that the ones for fathers simply don't exist. And that's why it's become a priority in the province to set those up. So that's what we're planning to do. We're planning to bring a couple of father-specific services that we've long been running in Toronto and Ottawa. And the one in particular, the sort of the flagship, is called Fathering After Separation or Divorce. So this is about dealing with family court, dealing with a potential hostile ex-partner, coming up with co-parenting plans that work, developing conflict resolution skills, putting your child's best interest front and center, but also not forgetting about your own health and welfare. The logic being, if a dad is not taking care of himself and letting his own health deteriorate and becoming anxious and, you know, suffering from depression, all of that, he's probably not going to be the best father that he can be. So the whole point is to really empower dads legally with respect to their health and with respect to navigating around a system which is biased. We want to deal with the biases and the unfairness, and we are doing that. But at the same time, how can we give dads the best chance at maintaining a positive and healthy relationship with their children within the unfairness of the system as it exists today? So that's a program that's been particularly popular and making a big difference at our offices in Ontario. We're desperate to bring that to Alberta. We've got lots of would-be clients in Alberta, lots of men that reach out to us from all over the province, in particular in Calgary. And so we're just so excited at the prospect of taking advantage of the government's potential support and the donor matching that I referred to earlier through the Patreon page to be able to finally bring that service and some of the other important ones to Calgary and to the province of Alberta.
Now, see, this is beneficial to everyone. And I know a lot of people might not think so, but the fact is the sort of the backbone of society is the sort of the functionality of the family. Even after a divorce, even after the family has broken up, some of that functionality can be preserved. And putting the tools for that, for the father's end of that, in the hands of the men who are going to be in that situation is the best way to deal with it. You really can't have so much top-down solutions in a situation like that and actually have them work, where you can have top-down support for bottom-up solutions. And that's basically a bottom-up solution. It's like that, I think I brought this up Tuesday in reference to something else, the teach a man to fish versus give a man a fish idea. And a lot of times government solutions involve handing out lots and lots of fish and hoping that people eventually figure it out for themselves, whereas this looks more to be the teaching the man to fish so that he can actually go out and take care of himself. And that, in terms of conflict resolution, in terms of co-parenting solutions in particular, those are really valuable, because a lot of times coordinating between exes is just, in addition to the emotional baggage that's attached to the breakup, there's the fact that they now have two entirely different lives. Like in my family, her second husband is a minister. They run a church. They live in a community that's about an hour away from where we live. And I had, at the time, multiple jobs. I don't think I've ever had just one job for very long. I usually have two or three. And my husband was working full-time, and we had a child after we got together. So there were ours, theirs, and then hers. And it was like coordinating all those schedules together was a huge pain. Well, when you have an adversarial attitude towards each other, dealing with that extra stressor is 1,000 times more difficult than it is if you're dealing with someone that you don't have any animosity, that you don't have that emotional baggage with, like, you know, your sister-in-law over planning the family Christmas. Dealing with your sister-in-law, who you're friends with, versus dealing with your ex-wife, who you're really not, totally different story. And giving out information and advice and education that provides with those men with those tools is a huge service. I don't know if people realize how big that is.
I think for a lot of fathers to have other dads who have gone through a similar situation, or maybe a little bit further along in resolving their issues, and then can provide mentorship and ongoing support. That's a big part of what we try to do. Is we've had a lot of men who have been clients who have gone through the fathering program or the mental health services that we offer, what have you, and then they want to give something back, and they come back and they facilitate support groups, or they're just available at our center to provide, to help with intake, so that when men come to the office for the first time, they see, you know, other guys that have gone through it. Just really quickly, if anybody wants to look into the policies I've been referring to, the government policies, the document's called How and Why to Include Fathers in Government-Funded Parenting Strategies. And this was authored in April 2016. So it really is, as I said, focused on funding, which is good for us because that's what we need to finally get the government financially to back us, and focused on fathers. And that's new. I've never seen anything like that from the government before, at any level across Canada.
It is a big success. The fact that they're finally starting to acknowledge that, and this is, it's not just Canada, it's the same in the United States. A lot of times dads have been treated, you know, for the last 50 years like walking wallets. So to see a government agency or a government entity of any kind start to acknowledge the importance of cooperation between fathers and mothers, in even after divorce, that's huge as well. Now, in terms of services and your new, I've already lost the paper I had, here I call it that, but the text file that I had the name of your planned organization in. But are you planning to then to expand into those services there as well?
Yeah, so the Canadian Center for Men and Families, that's the brand of all the centers that we operate in, and that's the brand that we would want to bring into Alberta. But as with all of our centers, they're all unique. So that's why we're studying up on what's really badly needed in this particular province, and listening to men and families who have reached out to us looking for support. And now if we're successful and we can open up offices, we'll be able to provide it. And the support that we provide will be tailored to the needs of the particular community where we'll be operating.
That's perfect. So you'll be able to go into different areas once you get more established and more funding and basically more support as you go. You'll be able to do this in other communities as well.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the idea.
Excellent. This is some of the best news that we've been able to sort of bring forward in a long time. And this is something that I've been kind of hoping for and watching for years and years, partly because of, like I said, my own family situation, but also just sort of being involved in the men's rights movement. It's probably going to take a combination of, you know, equality organizations that are not necessarily aligned specifically with men's rights or feminists or anything else like that, that are boots on the ground in areas like this, in provision of services and provision of education and things like that. that are willing to listen to both sides, that are willing to listen to, you know, men's rights activists have pointed out this information. Men's rights activists have discussed these issues. It's brought to light that these are the things that fathers are going through and so on. Feminists have pointed out these issues. They've brought to light what mothers are going through. They've discussed the following things. And then take all of the information and assess it outside of any ideological viewpoint and take action, which is basically what you guys are doing.
Yeah, our approach is exactly as you've described it. It isn't about being ideological. It is about building those partnerships wherever we can find them, you know, as I've described earlier. And I think people have responded generally positively to that kind of collaborative value, which is at the core of what we've always been about.
And it seems that has started to bring some people to the table. So it's actually been quite effective. Have you seen, besides on campuses, have you seen any other reduction in sort of the ideological attacks on your organization as a claiming that you're from one side or the other and trying to disparage your work?
Well, even on campus, actually, we haven't had any really noteworthy protests or disruptions in at least two and maybe more like 3 years. And the Warren Farrell one was a bit of an anomaly. We thought that it was going to sort of dog all of our steps forevermore, but the protests kind of petered out pretty quickly after a few events in 2013. And that's why it's going to be kind of interesting to see what happens when Warren comes back to University of Toronto. In a way, I guess we're being a bit provocative. It's the same day of the year. It's the same venue. People might see that as an attempt to sort of repeat history, but a lot of that's actually a coincidence. We thought it was time to bring him back. You know, we've had literally hundreds of speakers, so we're not a one issue or one speaker organization. We take on a lot of different things, as you've just heard about in our conversation today. Some of the services that we're interested in, they're quite diverse. But we haven't seen Warren in a long time. As I said, I find him one of the most principled men around, and certainly extremely admirable with the history that he has and what he's done for our cause. And he's just authored an amazing book that's getting rave reviews. That is The Boy Crisis. So it made sense to bring him back. I'll just mention while I'm talking about the event, you can still buy tickets. They're available at warrenferrell.eventbrite.com right now. And we may raise the prices closer to the event. We don't know yet, but we're reserving the right to do that. So please go and get your tickets right now at warrenferrell.eventbrite.com.
And definitely want to get tickets early, because with the fact that it is a talk by a best-selling author, and the fact that this is a particularly, it's new to get a lot of attention, essentially, an issue that he's talking about and everything, this event could possibly sell out. I hope to see something like that happen, where, you know, you get close to the event and it's actually hard to get tickets because they've all been bought. But I want to get you to say that address one more time.
Yeah, Warren Farrell. So he spells his name WARRENFARRELL. Sometimes people don't know how many R's or L's. So warrenferrell.eventbrite.com.
Okay.
And the other link is the Patreon campaign, which is patreon.com/menandfamilies. And that's to support our expansion of men centers out west to Alberta and to BC in Canada.
Alrighty. And I have put both of those links in the low bar of this live stream as well. I have a few super chats that I'm going to read off really quick. And I think unless either of my co-hosts have any questions that I didn't ask or any statements that I didn't make, this will probably be the end of the show. But we start out, we have Tyler Preston gave us $5 and said, speaking of Dr. Farrell, I remember the hit piece on him from The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and Samantha Bee. And I personally am proud to say I don't think I've ever seen a single episode of The Daily Show. It's on TV sometimes when I come into work and a coworker has left the TV on and I'll change the channel. I've never seen anything Samantha Bee did except for some segment where she she said something crappy that everybody got up in arms over and was all over Twitter. So I'm kind of unfamiliar with these guys and their work. Then we have... No, oh, this one. Justin, are you familiar with the R-Traps gay meme?
Afraid not.
Oh, then you're not going to know how to answer this question.
R-Traps are totally not gay.
No. The answer is only if you leave the lights on, or not if you turn off the lights, or... You know, not if you're in another state. You know, like, basically you insert anything you would say, oh, it's not cheating if, and then traps are not gay if, applies as well. So that's the formula that I figured out for it. But the super chat is Octavio Brannick, who says, who gave us R's. I'm not sure what the R's are. Gave us $2 in some currency that has an R. And says, hey, Justin, are traps gay? And then gave another two and said, do you still have any contact with CFI?
Oh, wow. Brings up a bit of ancient history. That's the Center for Inquiry, for those who aren't familiar. It was like a lifetime ago, actually. I'm still involved in secular humanism, but not through CFI. I decided to part ways. In the end, it was an amicable split, but you probably know from asking me that question that it was a bit rocky for a time, and because of my interest in men's issues. I thought that there was space in humanism for that, humanism being about, among other things, gender equality. I naively at the time thought that meant women's rights and men's rights, but at least at that time, there wasn't really that kind of interest in looking at the men's issue side. I have to say, though, in the last couple of years, I've been invited back by a number of humanist organizations across Canada to give talks about CAFE. So
that's encouraging.
Yeah, a lot of people have really come around. Not necessarily that they've changed their whole ideology, but they have become a lot more open-minded to consider other perspectives and other issues that they... that a lot of them would not have had any interest in 5 or 6 years ago. So I've been quite proud of the opportunity to return to some of those communities that I know quite well.
That's actually really, really encouraging, because it really is, honestly, a lot of the time, so many of the people who contact me after stumbling across my videos say things like, well, you know, I never really cared about this stuff, but then it, you know, like when it was put in front of me, I was like, oh, that's something that I should care about. And so the fact that you maybe had that bumpy breakup with CFI and then now they're coming around, maybe that's partly to do with the fact that you had that bumpy breakup in the first place. And they're taking a second look at some things that they just thought were non-issues initially. So that's really cool. I just also want to add, because Tyler Preston gave a super chat, but he also gave a chat saying that he would give $1 million.
I'm all ears.
$1 million to see me debate Samantha Bee. If he has $1 million, I will absolutely do that.
So there's only one problem with that. Debate requires an exchange of information, doesn't it?
No.
Okay, I was going to say, well, because otherwise it's just an argument.
It can just be a couple of chimpanzees throwing smartphones at each other.
Well, that works. I was going to say, because you have information, but I'm not so sure about Samantha Bee.
She's got plenty of snark.
Yeah, I was going to say, she's good at flinging poo.
Yeah,
you might end up with Karen making intellectual arguments and Samantha Bee responding by screeching and flinging poo.
Or just being snarky. But if Tyler Preston can raise $1 million, or even if he can raise $10,000 and get Samantha Bee to agree, I will definitely debate Samantha Bee.
Well, yeah, then I will host that quite happily. But I don't expect her to take us up on it. Maybe we could raise $1 million by promoting the show. So our last two, we have Catherine Scully gave us $20 Canadian and said, I hope to have a son someday and I want his rights to be respected. And Octavio Brannick said, gave us $2 again and said, "Walking wallet is how I used to call my father." And I don't know if that's actually serious or not, but it's something that people have referred to often enough because of the child support issues and everything.
Well, it might have been having his mother thought of his father. So.
Yeah, there's been a lot of moms that have done that, and it's a real shame. And hopefully with cooperating with organizations like CAFE, which is basically the first organization that's really dealing with these issues on the ground in this particular manner, and maybe we can change that. So, but before we end the show, did anybody else have anything that they wanted to add or ask?
I want that $1 million, Tyler Preston.
And Prim, what about you?
I think that everything has been covered. I know that Justin says he has to get going here, but I fully am in support of the whole thing coming up in Calgary. I think it's something that we desperately need. I think that it's something that everybody should try and support as much as possible. And both Justin and I are getting involved in that, and several other people. And yeah, I really, really encourage you to get to that Patreon and help if you can.
Now, I want to remind everybody that the Patreon and the Eventbrite links are in the low bar. That's patreon.com, Men and Families, and warrenferrell.eventbrite.com. So you have two links to use to support this. And hopefully as many people as possible will go see Dr. Warren Farrell speak, because it is always a treat to get to see him speak. And he has a lot of information to disclose. And with that, I would like to thank everybody for listening. Thanks, Justin, for coming on and giving us all of the information. And thanks to my two co-hosts for helping out. And thanks to everybody that makes HBR Talk happen. And good night.
Jugular. This is Honey Badger Radio. Radio with Bite.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.